4.
Evan knew his way around. He did not roam aimlessly, as we had been doing. He lived in this house and was familiar with its rooms and hallways. He knew which doors led where. Following his steps, avoiding the shadows, we exited the round room through the same door he had used. He stopped us before we walked through.
"We have to stay away from the little man," he said. "Whatever you do, don't let him see you."
The little man. Something about the appellation sent a shiver down my spine. "Who is the little man?" I asked.
"I don't know who he is. I don't know what he is,"
Evan shuddered.
"I just know what he does. Stay away from him. Don't let him see you."
He led us through a maze of passageways. The air grew warm again and fetid, as it had in the other passage, and I was suddenly struck by the absurd notion that these concrete corridors were not hallways for people to pass through, but heating ducts supplying warm air to different parts of the house. If that were true, the inhabitants of this dwelling would have to be giants. And though I knew the rooms were built for people of normal size, it was an image I could not shake. Several times, I thought I heard footsteps behind us, though when I looked back, I saw no one there. I was struck once more by not only the elaborate construction of the building, the way it incorporated disparate elements of the forgotten town of Plutarch into its composition, but by the professionalism of its assembly. Yes, there were parts that were clearly the result of Frank's substandard skills, but others were astoundingly well made. How could the incompetent handyman, who lived across the street from us in Randall, have created such a perfectly fused amalgam of styles? It was inconceivable to me, and it reinforced the idea that he had access to a power we could not even comprehend. I imagined a scenario in which Frank kept adding onto the house, never stopping, until the structure spanned the surrounding desert, reached San Antonio, and continued on, engulfing other cities until the entire country was incorporated within its walls. It sounded crazy, and it was. But when I thought about all we'd encountered, recalled what Owen had said about Kaylee's theory of increased supernatural activity building up to something, the impossible didn't seem quite so impossible. Where was Kaylee, I wondered. Had she managed to contact the law and bring someone back? If she had, it hadn't mattered. We'd been here for God knew how long, and no one had come to rescue us. Maybe the rescuers had become trapped as well. There seemed no end to this nightmare, and I was convinced that the only way to stop it was to dispatch Frank and burn this house to the ground. Dispatch Frank. Did I really think I would be able to kill the man if it came down to it? I was a suburban real estate agent who had never even fired a gun. Was I really going to use the hammer tucked in my belt to smash in Frank's head? If given the opportunity, could I actually perform such a brutal act? I thought of Billy. Yes, I could. Evan had led us to a large dark gallery that reminded me of the Hall of Mammals in the Natural History Museum. At the museum, dark wood walls were broken up every few yards by lighted dioramas populated with taxidermied animals, placed in scenes that resembled their native habitats. Here, the layout was the same, only instead of nature scenes, the lighted squares revealed offices and bedrooms, kitchens and art studios, family rooms and libraries. There were people living in the displays. Ensconced in rooms that were essentially their own little living quarters, they ignored us as we passed. We saw a well-heeled woman primping in front of a dresser mirror, a middle-aged couple sitting on a sofa and staring blankly at the space, an older man at a workbench whittling something out of wood, a younger man in a rocking chair reading a book. Were they alive or dead? People or ghosts? Did they know where they were? Or were they trapped as Terry and I had been, living in their own alternate reality? Who are they? I asked. Evan shrugged. Did you ever talk to them?
I tried. Years ago. They didn't want to talk to me. I'm not even sure they talked to each other. Or know where they are.
It was odd conversing with this sober Evan. There was no sign of the showbiz-obsessed, easily excitable television writer I knew. And I wondered when that spirit had been leached out of him. Terry approached a room on the right, where a young woman using a treadle sewing machine was making a flower print dress. Dozens of other dresses hung on racks behind her. "Excuse me," Terry said. "Can I ask you a question?" The woman looked at her, confused. She did not answer, and there was a haunted look in her eyes that belied the work her busy hands were doing. I turned to a man in the room opposite, a guy about my age in a bare monastic cell furnished only by a cot. The man was on his knees praying. "Hello," I said. He looked up. For a brief second, I saw a flicker of hope in his eyes. Then it was washed away by what seemed like bafflement and an overwhelming despair. Immediately, he returned to his prayers. Evan was right. They did not seem to know where they were. I got the same sense from them as I had from those ghosts we'd encountered in the passageway, that they were lost and searching for something. Meaning, purpose, a redeemer, a god. Ultimately, it didn't matter that they were here. No matter where they were, they would have felt trapped and lost in a pointless existence. And Terry turned to me and said, "They're not going to give us any help." We kept walking. Between two of the rooms was a stairwell, and Evan took us up the steps one flight, two flights, three flights, four, until we were in a large empty space that looked like the floor of an abandoned factory. Suspicious ambient light illuminated the vast room, and within the accordion ceiling, I saw glowing skylights. Were we at the top of the house? Was there a way to break through those windows onto the roof and find a way out and down? Evan didn't stop, but continued on, certain of where he was going, and Terry and I followed. We could always come back here, I reasoned. Far off from some other room came the faint but unmistakable sound of infants screaming in agony. "Those are babies," Terry cried, distraught. Evan did not respond. "They're torturing babies." "They're just crying," I said placatingly, but I knew she was right. We both did. As faint as they were, the screams were unlike anything I'd ever heard. Evan's voice was sober.
"It's the little man. That's what he does."
We strode quickly across the empty floor, and while there was no fluctuation in temperature, no variation in the feel of the air, nothing physical that was in any way changed, something had altered, although I had no idea what it was, or where or when it had happened. I grew gradually more aware of my arms as I walked. They felt awkward to me, and I wasn't sure if I was walking the way I usually did. Was I swinging them out too far? Not far enough? I couldn't tell. Everything I tried felt wrong, and I started wondering about my steps. Was my stride too long? Too short? Something about the way I was walking felt off, and I glanced over at Terry, unnerved to see a disconcerted expression on her face that perfectly mirrored the way I felt. Evan was walking so fast he was practically running, and it occurred to me that he was moving quickly through the room on purpose, so as not to let whatever we were experiencing affect us or sink in.
"Hurry up," he croaked. "We're almost there."
We were rapidly approaching the opposite end of the room, and in the center of a bleak industrial wall was a perfectly round opening that looked as though it belonged in a submarine.
"Through here," Evan said.
We ducked through the doorway. And Terry and Evan were gone. I was in the living room of our A-frame as it had looked in the 1980s. My dad and my brother were sitting on the couch, playing with the primitive electronic game Simon. Wedges of primary colors lit up randomly on the circular toy to the accompaniment of synthesized musical tones, and the two of them took turns pressing down on the colors, trying to replicate the pattern. A painful pang wrenched my heart. Billy looked just as he had when we'd first gotten the vacation home, but it surprised me how much I had forgotten about his appearance. His hair was lighter than I recalled, his smile more innocent. Time and memory had made him seem more mature in retrospect, perhaps because I'd been close to that age myself. But I saw now that he'd been a true child, a little boy. He'd had his whole life ahead of him, a life he'd been denied, a life that had been taken away from him. By Frank. I'd never been entirely sure whether Billy's death had been intentional or the result of Frank's incompetence, but at this point, it didn't matter. After all I'd learned about Frank, I knew he was guilty of far more than I ever could have suspected. My dad looked up at me, and he smiled in the way that he had before Billy's death, but that I had never seen after. Daniel, you want to play? I wanted to, more than anything else in the world. I wanted to sit on the couch next to my dad and my brother and be with them again. But even though they were pretending I was still 10 years old, I was an adult. And it was this heartbreaking discrepancy that kept me grounded in reality, that made me realize they were not really there, and this was a false echo of a reunion that could never be. "I'll beat you this time," Billy told me, grinning as he held up the Simon, and my eyes teared up. There was a noise from the rear of the A-frame, what sounded like someone bumping against a wall. "Are you okay?" my dad called out, glancing in that direction. "Mommy?" Billy said, Simon lighting up red, yellow, blue, and making beep-bop-boop noises in his hand. It emerged from my parents' bedroom into the short hall beyond the kitchen and turned in my direction. The clothes it wore were my mother's, but the being inhabiting those clothes was unformed, pale arms, ending not in hands and fingers, but in vaguely rounded stumps, the pallid face so ill-defined that I was not even sure it had features. I froze at the sight of it and realized that any fear I had felt before this moment was nothing compared to the all-encompassing terror that unformed figure instilled in me. It began creeping toward the living room, moving slowly, and I was reminded of the way a snail propelled itself forward through undulations of its slimy body. Descending footsteps sounded on the stairway that led to the loft where Billy and I had had our beds, and seconds later, Frank stepped into the living room. He was dressed as always in engineer's overalls, and his eyes peered out at me from behind his thick, black-framed glasses. "Daniel," he said, "glad you could make it." He did not seem as arrogant as he had at the other house. There was a subdued quality to his voice, a subservience in his manner. And when he stepped forward so he could peek around the corner and see into the hall, I realized what that thing masquerading as my mom had to be. The Dark Wife. It continued to creep slowly forward, and Frank awaited its arrival in the room with a mixture of anticipation and submissiveness. He didn't go to meet it, though. He waited. And that told me a lot. On the couch, Billy and my dad remained unmoving, like two robots whose power had been suddenly shut off. The Simon in Billy's hands was the only sign of life, its flashing lights and electronic sounds continuing unabated. And still, the Dark Wife advanced with its snail crawl, faceless and utterly silent. Frozen in place, frightened beyond words, I could do nothing but watch in horror as the thing approached. I could feel its power, rolling over me in unseen waves. I did not know what it was. I could not know what it was. The explanation for its existence was utterly beyond my comprehension. I believed it was the god for which those souls we'd encountered were searching, a god that Frank had been serving since he discovered it in Vietnam. At the last minute, self-preservation trumped fear, and I found myself backing up toward the front door of the A-frame through which I'd entered. Behind me, my fingers found the knob, but it wouldn't turn. I was trapped, with no way to escape, and I instinctively reached for the hammer in my waistband. The Dark Wife had reached the edge of the kitchen counter, and in a strangely formal, oddly courtly move, Frank reached for its hand. There was a sickening fusion of flesh where his rough fingers met the white, rounded stump. I had to get out of here. Filled with an almost animalistic desperation, I turned to the side, keeping one eye on the horrifying couple, and used the hammer to shatter the window to the right of the doorway. The reaction was instantaneous. The dark wife visibly blanched, and Frank's face contorted with rage.
"What are you doing?"
he yelled, apoplectic. There was nothing beyond the glass other than an inky blackness so thick that it seemed to have mass. I could not get out through there, but I was still desperate to escape. And remembering how cheap the walls of our prefab home had been, I shifted my efforts to the space between the window and the door, swinging the hammer as hard as I could and using it to punch a hole in the painted drywall.
"I built that!" Frank screamed.
I hit the wall again. And again. The house around me flickered, and behind our vacation home, I saw the bones of the surrounding structure, a primitive hodgepodge of beams and supports, rafters and planks. Terry and Evan were there as well, nearby, and they saw me at the same instant I saw them, just before the A-frame reasserted itself around me. I hit the wall again, then swung the hammer hard at the door itself.
"Stop!"
Frank ordered, and there was not just anger, but fear in his voice. I'm sure he wanted to attack me, and most certainly would have if he'd been able to do so, but his hand was attached to the dark wife, and the dark wife was not doing well. Each swing of the hammer was like a blow to its body, and it was rooted in place. Even its slow progress halted. The dark wife was connected to the building, I realized. Not just our little vacation home, but the enormous outer structure in which it was enclosed. A broader realization came to me. It was the house that was holding all of this together. Frank's construction that had trapped us and everyone else in this place. It had always been Frank's handiwork. His interred bodies and stolen materials that had been at the root of everything. That had summoned whatever power granted him the ability to do what he had done. My hammer punched another hole in the drywall. And then Terry and Evan were by my side, using the opportunity of that flicker to pass through the temporarily dissolved walls. For the first time since we'd found him again, Evan seemed confident and enthusiastic, sensing possibility in the weakness we'd found. Frank had not stopped screaming a profane string of threats, but he was sidelined and impotent, and I told Terry to use her hatchet to start wailing on anything she could find. I quickly led Evan over to the boxy 1980s entertainment center against the wall opposite the couch. My dad had kept tools in a junk drawer below the shelf holding the television, and I opened it, gratified to find that the replication of our house was accurate down to the level of cabinet contents. I found a claw hammer, handed it to Evan, and we began attacking the nearest wall in earnest, working in tandem to create and widen an opening in the cheap building material. Drawing back my arm, I swung again and practically fell forward when I encountered only air. The wall was gone. The A-frame was gone. And Evan, Terry, and I were in that other room I had briefly seen through the flickering walls. Billy and my dad were gone too, and their absence wrenched at my heart. I knew they weren't real, but the fact that I had not been able to say goodbye to whatever they were filled me with a deep sense of sadness. I had lost them again, though I had not really had them back, and that loss filled me with regret. It also renewed my hatred for Frank, and made me determined to stop him once and for all. This room was far more crudely constructed, like a clubhouse a not particularly handy dad would make with his son. Ill-fitting sheets of plywood were hammered with too many nails onto randomly joined 2x4s that acted as an off-center frame. On the unpainted walls were random letters and strange symbols drawn in red. This was a room I could tell Frank had actually built, and without pausing, the three of us assaulted its walls. We needed to tear down as much as we could, as quickly as we could. It was the only way to fight back. Frank and the dark wife had disappeared, although whether that was for their own safety or in order to prepare for an attack, I had no way of knowing. I also couldn't afford to wait and find out. Assuming that those letters and symbols had some sort of mystical purpose, I called Terry over to where Evan and I were bashing our hammers against the wall and told her to use her hatchet to obliterate as much of the red writing as she could. The results were remarkable. From behind the plywood came the sounds of lumber falling and concrete cracking, and when I looked through one of the interstitial breaks in the badly built wall, I saw the collapsing of other rooms beyond. Terry kept chopping, smashing into splinters a circle connected to the letter X. There was a whoosh of air, a sensation of falling, as though the rudimentary room we were in was dropping down an elevator shaft, but there was no resultant crash that followed. The feeling of movement simply stopped, and when Evan and I managed to knock a hole in the plywood and then pull off a section of wall, we saw what looked like a crypt or vault, a chamber with a dirt floor and stone sides, dim flickering light issuing from a kerosene lantern hanging from a hook. With a creak of nails, we pulled off another piece of plyboard, tossing it aside. I pounded off the 2x4 behind it, and the way was clear to exit the room we were in and enter the larger, darker chamber. Was it a basement? It looked and felt like it, but there was no way to know. The room had a permanence, however, that had been lacking in the other rooms we'd encountered. Even the concrete corridors had seemed less substantial than this dark rock vault, and I realized that we were in what had to be the heart of the house. There was a huge hole in the center of the dirt floor in front of us, and sticking close together, the three of us approached. Glancing into its inky depths gave me a disorienting sense of vertigo, and I stepped back, afraid of falling.
What? What is it? Terry wondered.
We both looked toward Evan, but he shook his head. As familiar as he was with the house, even he was stumped.
What do you think's down there? Terry asked.
I don't know, I admitted. Evan had moved over to the wall on our left, and he began chipping away at the stone with the claw end of his hammer. It was a good idea. If vandalizing the A-frame and taking apart that plywood room had started things unraveling, destroying what we could of this vault should speed up the process even more. That mysterious hole had convinced me that this room was the key to whatever Frank was doing, and the fact that the room had been built like a fortress around the pit, as though to protect it, made me confident that this was indeed the key to the house. I raised my own hammer, about to strike at the stone, but a hint of movement off to the right revealed the presence of another man, watching us. He'd been standing so still that I had not noticed him before, but as I glanced in his direction, I saw others as well. Immobile against the wall, their skin bleached of all color, as if they had been bred in the darkness of the pit. They were wearing the uniforms of police officers, and I knew they belonged to those abandoned patrol cars outside. I didn't know what was wrong with them or what they were, and while I did not believe they were dead, I did not think they were alive either. Terry was hitting the wall now too, using the dull edge of her hatchet to attack the stone, and though I kept my eye on the cops, they made no effort to stop us. I was chipping away at the wall myself, gratified to see small chunks of rock break off and fall to the dirt, but I was making no real progress, and neither was anyone else. The room was too well constructed, which led me to believe that Frank had not made it himself. Where was Frank? Hiding? No, that was not his style. He was watching, waiting, planning something. Tearing down what he'd built had enraged him, but it also seemed to have weakened him. His strength was connected to the durability of his creation. And judging by what we'd seen of the disappearing rooms around us, Terry's obliteration of the writing and symbols on the wooden walls had probably debilitated him further. Was there something in here that we could employ to similar effect? I looked over at Terry and Evan, all of us with our puny little tools masquerading as weapons, and thought that we'd better find something, and quick, because when Frank did return, he would be armed for bear. We weren't gaining much traction attacking the stone wall, and I was about to say that we should go back into the previous room and wipe out what was left of the red blood markings on the plywood, when I glanced in that direction and saw movement behind the open beams. A small, dark figure that seemed to emerge from the wood itself, from a complicated scribble that took up a large lower section of a ply board sheet. Evan saw it too, and cried out in fear at the sight, clearly recognizing it for what it was. The figure moved slowly around the other room, disappearing for a moment, and was out of sight until emerging into the opening through which we'd come, illuminated by the dim light of the kerosene lamp. I knew instantly who it was, and understood why Evan had screamed. The little man. He was ancient and Asian, and he had to be the excommunicated cleric who had mentored Frank in Vietnam. He was wearing Vietnamese peasant clothes, what Americans had always derisively referred to as pajamas, and he clutched what looked like some type of ceremonial knife in his tiny hands. Had he shrunk, I wondered, or had he always been this small? He poked his head into the vault and looked carefully in all directions to make sure there was no attacker lying in wait. He seemed to be neither dwarf nor midget, although his proportions were those of a child. He was an evil man, I knew that, and the expression on his face was one of undisguised malevolence. I glanced from Evan to Terry. Could we take him? There were three of us, and we were bigger. Two of us had hammers, and one a hatchet. But he had emerged from a wall, clutching some sort of ceremonial knife in his hands, and was God knew how many years old, with who knew what powers. No doubt he could kill us easily, and our wandering spirits would be absorbed into the house with no one ever the wiser. There was nowhere to run, no way to escape, but as the little man approached the edge of the pit, glanced dismissively at us, then stared into the blackness, I understood that he was not going to kill us. He didn't care about us at all. He was here to kill Frank. He hated Frank. The realization shocked me. My assumption had been that everything within the walls of this structure was working together as one cohesive unit toward a single common goal. But I remembered how in the rest home, Dong Nguyen had told us that the outcast cleric who had been Frank's mentor had been killed by his disciple. So if indeed this was him, he had a definite reason to hate Frank. Not only that, but if he was here, that meant he had been taken from his country and installed in this Texas monstrosity. Talk about the wandering dead. He could not have gotten any farther from where he was supposed to be than where he was. The little man began chanting. The words were in Vietnamese, and even though I did not know the language, I could tell there was something off about them. This was not the musical dialect Dong and May had exchanged. It was harsher, darker, with accents and cadences that seemed dissonant and discordant. The chanting was answered by a voice from the pit, a smooth, almost liquid voice that responded in a manner that I had never heard before, that no one had ever heard before. These were new words. Words that had been spoken before only in hell, and the sound of them rocked me to the core, grating against everything I knew or thought I knew, conjuring images I would not have believed myself capable of imagining. I staggered back against the stone, feeling as though my brain was about to explode. From the agonized expression on Terry's face, I could tell that the words had the same effect on her, and she dropped her hatchet, using both hands to cradle her head. On the other side of me, Evan was whimpering, and when I turned toward him, I saw that he had fallen to his knees. From the center of the pit rose the Dark Wife, or what had been the Dark Wife. It was not wearing clothes anymore, but was nude, and despite the fact that Frank had dressed it as my mother, its unadorned body possessed no feminine features. It was neither mother nor wife, but some sort of embryonic creature. What I felt in my bones? To be an emergent god. For there was something distinctly larval about its appearance, and I realized that it was not yet fully formed, not completely finished. What would happen when it was? I did not even want to guess. I only knew that Frank needed to die in order to stop its evolution. The would-be god was still speaking in that abhorrent tongue, its hateful language drilling painfully into my brain. The little man continued his chanting as well. The two were not engaged in a dialogue, but were talking at each other, around each other, past each other. He was summoning it from the pit, and it arose from the darkness as though stationed atop a rising platform. There was no platform, however, and seconds later, the slimy white stumps of its unformed feet floated above the hole's edge, and alighted on the dirt floor. The cacophony was becoming unbearable, and I was forced to drop my hammer in order to plug my ears. It helped only a little. Even muffled, the hellish duet bored, unwanted, into my skull. The little man stepped forward, ceremonial knife extended. With no preamble, no muss, no fuss, he thrust it into the creature, its point entering the slimy white flesh just above the thigh. He moved the knife to the left, to the right, up, down, carving a symbol into the being as its liquid voice devolved into a series of disgusting grunts. The nascent god's substance was like butter, the blade slicing through it with seemingly no resistance, and the Asian mystic stepped back as sections of flesh slid away from that carved symbol in gelatinous segments, slipping to the dirt where they reformed into four smaller facsimiles of the original figure. Those repulsive grunts, like the sound of gargling glass, were issuing from four mouths now, in a higher pitch than before, but in perfect synchronization. Suddenly, Frank was standing next to the split forms of the god. Had he been there all along? Had he come through some concealed door in the room? Or had he just appeared out of thin air? I didn't know, and it didn't matter. He was here now, and while he looked frighteningly old, the age he should have been, he was by no means enfeebled. He started purposely toward the little man, an expression of undisguised wrath on his sallow, wrinkled face. Ignoring the pain in my head, I reached down, grabbing my hammer for protection. The little man definitely wanted to kill Frank. Until now, he'd been unable to do so. Otherwise, he would have finished off the man long before now. But he appeared to have faith in the weapon he wielded. His face filled with rage and hate, he held the knife with supreme confidence. Having stopped chanting, he shouted at Frank in Vietnamese, and Frank responded calmly in the same language. Frank had killed his mentor the first time, so the little man was already dead, but I was still hoping for an epic fight. It was not to be. The Asian man thrust quickly with the knife, but Frank easily stepped aside and avoided the blade. Bellowing with fury, he picked up the little man from behind and threw him into the pit. And that was it. There was no prolonged battle between two powerful necromancers, or whatever they were. There was only a brief one-sided attack, a lunge, an apprehension, and then the little man was tossed into the black hole, disappearing instantly, the whole thing literally over and done with in seconds. But the knife fell onto the dirt in front of the pit. Had he dropped it accidentally, or had it been intentional? I had no idea. I only hoped Frank had not seen it, because that thing did seem to have power. It had cut the embryonic god into pieces, and the little man had obviously thought it had the capacity to take out Frank as well. The kerosene lamp dimmed for a moment. If it had been an electric bulb, I would have assumed a power surge, but this was something else. And when the illumination brightened again seconds later, the miniature gods looked more fully formed, and actually female. There were chest protuberances that hinted of breasts, budding clefts, and where the thighs met, separations in the formerly solid appendages that were supposed to be hands and feet. My eyes were on that knife. Terry, Evan, and I were huddled together. We had all retrieved our weapons, and either the sounds assaulting our ears were not as horrible as they had been, or we were getting used to them, because we were able to speak. I nodded toward the knife, making sure Frank was not looking in my direction, and speaking low, said, "Spread out. Evan, go to the left. Terry, go to the right. Kick the dirt. Scratch the walls, make noise. Do whatever damage you can. I'm going after that knife." Terry shook her head furiously. "You can't. It's too close. Go," I whispered, and pulled away from them. They had no choice but to follow my orders. I hung back as they drew Frank's attention with their cries, and was gratified to see him flinch as Evan clawed stone with his hammer, as Terry used her heels to dig indentations in the dirt floor and randomly struck sections of the wall, both of them circling around the edges of the room. All four incarnations of the god did that flickering thing from the A-frame, and their cries slipped out of sync. "No!" Frank yelled. "Stop it!" The hole in the floor was between him and Terry, but Evan was easy to reach across an open space, and Frank lurched toward him.
You bastard, he screamed. I'll make sure you never fucking escape.
This was my opportunity, and the instant he stepped away from the pit, I dove forward. The knife was near, too near, one of the miniature gods, and the back of my hand brushed the creature as I grabbed the handle of the blade. I felt searing heat and excruciating cold, a repugnant texture against my skin that made me think of congealed mucus. Without thinking, without stopping to ponder options or consider strategies, I raised the knife and drove it into the midsection of the small figure. Acting on instinct, I drew the blade through the soft flesh, cutting the body in two. Maybe there were words I was supposed to say, symbols I was supposed to carve, but I knew nothing about any of that, and I trusted in the power of the blade itself to extinguish the creature's life. No such luck. I successfully cut the form in half, but the god did not die. Its white flesh quivered and flowed, rearranging itself, and then there were two of them instead of one. I needed to kill Frank. Looking up from the still-developing bodies, I saw that this might be easier than I thought. Frank had indeed grabbed Evan, but Evan was defending himself with his hammer, landing blows to Frank's midsection that seemed to be doing actual damage. And Terry had come around from the other side of the pit and was attacking with her hatchet from the rear. I saw no wounds, no blood, but Frank was being battered, and his wrinkled face was grimacing, pain evident as he winced with each strike. Terry landed a blow with her hatchet, slicing into his shoulder, causing him to scream with fury. Could they kill Frank? Possibly. But this was my fight. I had started us on this journey. I had brought us all here, and it was my responsibility to finish it. In my mind, I could still hear the voices of Billy and my dad as they sat on the couch playing with Simon, voices I had not heard for decades, that I'd almost forgotten. And it was the silencing of those voices, the loss again of my family, that spurred me forward. If anybody was going to kill Frank, it was going to be me. Did I have any moral qualms? No. I had never killed anyone, could not even remember ever getting into a fight or hurting another person, so this went against everything I had ever stood for, everything I was and wanted to be. But I didn't care. I rushed toward him, knife at the ready.
You can't,
Frank began, and I stabbed him in the throat. There was a shift in the air around us. His voice dissolved into a drowning gurgle as blood spurted and he collapsed, the life draining from his body. The figures on the dirt twisted and withered, white flesh darkening to gray and then to black, the no longer humanoid forms emitting high-pitched sounds like the screaming of dying squirrels, their substance leaching into the dirt and creating a muddy mess. Frank stopped moving, blood trickling now instead of spurting from the wound in his neck. Above our heads, the ceiling disappeared, and past it, I could see the house, Frank's house, the rooms shifting, changing position, walls and floors gradually fading. It was not an instantaneous process. We stood there unmoving while the activity continued, and at the end of it, the only thing left was the open stone room we were in and the adjoining plywood construction that we had managed to partially demolish. And back of that, we could see the world outside, the rental car in which we'd arrived, and the dirt road through the desert beyond. Holding Terry's hand, I hurried out, in case the opportunity to leave was once again taken away. Evan followed quickly. From this vantage point, I could see bits and pieces of the house that were still extant. There was no gigantic pile of rubble as might have been expected from a building that size, only individual sections of wall, occasional freestanding doors, and a few stairway segments. Here and there, men and women were staggering about, freed from whatever trap, cage, or dream in which Frank had had them ensnared. Mark's body lay just outside the door we had used to enter the building, which was still standing strong within its frame. He was dead, mutilated by some sort of wild animal or monster, but he had not been dead for long. There was a lot of blood, and the blood was still fresh, not dried. I walked over to where he lay, grief-stricken with the knowledge that he had been another victim, that he had not lived to see our victory over Frank. The one goal of his life had been denied him, and my eyes filled with tears as I recalled the little boy who'd lived across the street, my friend. If I'd had a jacket, I would have placed it over his face, but I didn't, and I turned away disconsolately, leaving his open, permanently terrified eyes to stare vacantly up at the sky. "Hey!" One of the wandering men was waving at us, trying to get our attention, and as he approached, I saw that it was Twiggs. He held up his camera, grinning hugely. "I got some amazing shit here, man. Amazing shit. This is gonna be one hell of a show." I wiped the tears from my eyes, scanning the remaining individuals stumbling about, but saw no one I recognized. There was no sign of Owen, and I assumed the worst. Terry was on the same wavelength. "I don't see Owen," she said. I shook my head. "I don't either." "Holy shit," Twiggs said, recognizing Evan beneath the ears. "What happened to you?" I didn't hear the writer's response. I was looking down at the bloody knife in my hand. In the bright sunlight, I could see a lined pattern tempered into the blade, intricate carvings in the handle, which appeared to be made of ivory or bone. Amidst the chaos, practical considerations reasserted themselves, and I realized it was entirely possible that I could be charged with murder. Beyond the remnants of the rickety plywood room, the roofless stone chamber still stood, an island of permanence among the ruins of insubstantiality. There seemed no threat to it now, and I let go of Terry's hand and retraced my steps, intending to toss the weapon into the pit. The hole was still there, but Frank's body wasn't. And almost as soon as my mind registered that fact, he lunged for me. Like the stoic, bleached policeman still standing against the stone, Frank had blended into the wall, as motionless as a corpse, waiting for me. He was dead, as the gaping hole in his throat and the blood that covered his clothes attested, but somehow he had become reanimated, and he attacked me with a ferocity I had never seen before. The expression on his face was frozen, and the unsettling, half-smiling countenance reminded me of nothing so much as the way he had looked peeking out of his pickup window the first time he had offered me and Billy a ride. But his arms and legs were flailing like a madman's. It was luck, more than intent, that allowed the knife to strike home when I lashed out to defend myself. I stabbed outward, and the blade passed between Frank's grasping hands and into his chest. I twisted it, pulled out, and was ready to strike again, but his body collapsed in front of me and lay still, crumpled on the ground. No blood spilled from the new wound, but through his torn shirt, I could see that the skin around the gash had turned a deep black. I backed up, afraid he was going to come to life yet again, but his body remained unmoving. On impulse, I did throw the knife into the hole, then grabbed Frank's right arm, the one on top, and dragged him out of the stone room, thinking it might have had something to do with reviving him. Police cars were arriving. I could hear their sirens approaching, see the dust from their tires. The psychic had made her way back to San Antonio and contacted the law. I pulled Frank over the plyboard floor of the adjoining room and left him on the desert ground beyond, his head hitting a rock where I dropped him. Terry had taken my hand, pulling me away, and I suddenly realized that I was crying again. Police cars, sheriff's SUVs, county jeeps, pickup trucks, a whole convoy of vehicles had arrived and were braking to a halt next to our own rental car. Uniformed officers emerged, moving slowly, obviously confused. Eventually, I knew they would find Frank's body and take it back to San Antonio, where it would be cremated or receive a proper burial. Either way, it would be hundreds of miles away from this place, the one-time location of Plutarch, the location where he was supposed to be interred. He would wander then, yet another homeless spirit. And that made me feel good. The bastard did not deserve to be at rest. And I hoped that whatever afterlife he had was wretched, unbearable, and endless. Terry held me close. I was still crying, but there was a sense of gratification mixed in with the tears. A man in a sheriff's uniform approached, a bewildered expression on his face. Whatever had been here was gone, and the only things left were after effects and questions. I glanced over at Frank's lifeless body. He was dead, and I was glad. He would never repair another roof, fix another floor, remodel another room, build another house. For Billy, I thought proudly, the tears rolling down my cheeks. For Billy. This concludes the reading of The Handyman by Bentley Little. Copyright 2017 by Bentley Little. This book was read by Chris Andrew Shula and directed by Jamie Matler. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Dominic Abel Literary Agency, Incorporated, and was produced in 2017 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.